Hello, Colm O'Regan here. Welcome back to The World Etc. for our second episode of a new monthly podcast in association with Trokra. Once again, we'll be looking at topical issues facing people around the world. And today I'm joined by two very interesting guests. Later we'll have Razan Ibrahim. She's a journalist with Storyful and a regular speaker about Syria and refugee rights. But first up, I'm talking to broadcaster John Creedon, who recently travelled to Guatemala, visiting indigenous Mayan communities to see the various issues affecting them and the country as a whole. Getting straight into Guatemala, the Central American country is one with a turbulent modern history, which impacts on a number of contemporary issues. These issues include corruption, land rights, and the legacy of a 36-year civil war that raged from the 60s right through to the 90s. For those who are unfamiliar with the recent history of Guatemala, just some of the astonishing figures involved. There were 200,000 people killed during the Guatemalan civil war. 45,000 were abducted and disappeared. The vast majority of these crimes, over 90% of them, were perpetrated by the military, which essentially attempted to wipe out the Mayan race under the false premise that the indigenous people were supporting anti-government guerrilla groups. To find out a bit more about Guatemala today from a personal point of view, joining me on the line is broadcaster John Creedon. Hello, John. Thanks for joining us.
Not at all, Colm. My pleasure. Great to be with you.
John, you're known for your travel broadcasting abroad and also in the work you do around Ireland and finding the hidden gems and uncovering that which is hidden in plain sight. This was a slightly different travel trip under different auspices. How was Guatemala for you?
Guatemala was very different, I'd have to say. I've been lucky insofar as being an 80s dad. I had my four children before I was 25. So most of my travelling has been reserved for the second part of my life. From the 40s onwards, really, I suppose, I've been on the road and I'm finding it difficult to get off it. So, yeah, over the years with the travel show and just on holidays and so on, I've got around a bit. Guatemala was different. I've encountered poverty before in Central Africa, in Malawi, around Mozambique, and I've seen it in India, and I've seen it in rural China and in other places. So meeting someone who's barefoot, encounters like that, that wouldn't be new or a huge shock to my system. However, the big issue in Guatemala, while it's not, say, the AIDS epidemic that you have in Africa, I didn't really encounter any distended bellies or anything like that, but I did meet a people who really have been beaten up for centuries. And the main issue in Central America, it seems to me, is justice. All the problems seem to spur from injustice.
Based on the conversations you had with people there during your time, John, what was the abiding reason, the sense you got of what was the injustice that the people spoke of?
Well, the common denominator was injustice. There were many, byproducts of injustice. For example, you have disappeared. There are thousands of people still unaccounted for after the social upheaval that went on in Guatemala for about 30 years when an American-backed military crackdown on the people, on any form of organization, as soon as people formed cooperatives, whether they be workers' cooperatives or farmers' cooperatives, they were dismissed as being communist, cue the backlash. And so after years and years and years of that, the problems are manifold. For example, the disappeared is one huge burning issue still in Guatemala. During those troubles, men and boys were rounded up and arbitrarily executed. There was no trial, nothing like that. There are mass graves dotted all over Guatemala. People want their relatives back. And there were some inroads made in that, thanks to the United Nations and the work of Trokra, Free Legal Aid, supports like that. There was some progress being made. There's now a terrible risk that all of that is going to be rolled backwards, because there's talk now of a general amnesty, which means that most of the disappeared will remain disappeared. There were examples of systematic sexual abuse behind barracks walls, a standard negotiation line between the military or big business and small farmers was, you can negotiate with me or I can negotiate with your widow. And more often than not, it was the widow with whom they negotiated because the men and the sons disappeared. These women were then defenceless. Many of them were forced to go and work in the military barracks in their local area. The work extended to sexual slavery. That's what it amounted to. And eventually, some of the women there actually took a case. In one town we visited, in Sepo Sarko, women who had been systematically abused within the barracks walls, took a case. After much chatter amongst themselves about should we raise our hands, should we mention this, under the protection of the United Nations, TROCRA, as I mentioned, and TROCRA's partners on the ground, like ECAP, these women were supported. The community was supported in terms of this case being taken, because many people felt that this would only bring shame on our village. How can we win this anyway? Guatemala City is 7 hours away. We don't have the money. We don't speak Spanish. We only speak Mayan languages. How can we go and make a case against the mighty military and against the plantation owners? We're on a hiding to nothing. And they were, until TROCRA and Cook and ECAP and other groups came in. There was counselling for the village, there was counselling for the women, there was free legal aid, there was transport, there was even hotel bills paid. And over 6 years, those women, inch by inch by inch by inch, got over the line, got justice, and two generals were sent down as a result of that process. But now the fear is that all of this is going to be rolled back, and there'll be general amnesty, trials will not go ahead, and the perpetrators of systematic violence and abuse will be off scot-free.
And for you, did you start to realise the importance of bearing witness to that, that you go, you talk to people, and you tell the world? Obviously, lots of organisations and NGOs are telling the world about this, but establishing that human connection by meeting the people there, how do you feel about that now?
Well, what I discovered really within a day or so was that there was a part of me felt, I don't want to sit there with my notebook and bring people through a trauma all over again so that I can document it. So quite often, these were very relaxed conversations just about life. I remember on one occasion talking to Carmen, who was one of the women abused in Sepo Sarko, an elderly lady now, and I apologized to her. I said, I'm so sorry to have to come and ask you about this story when no one seems to come and ask you about the animals or about the maize crop or about your grandchildren. I'm sorry that it's about this story again. Now, this had to go through Spanish interpretation into Mayan and backwards. But no, her reply to me was, no, you're a very welcome man. And I will continue to tell my story because we told the truth and we tell our story over and over again. So it wasn't a case really of bringing them through another form of briefing or debriefing. It was more conversational. And I was at pains to point out also to the people, say, we met in Casa Migrante, which is the migrant house. It's like a halfway house or a stopping off point for individuals and for caravans that are fleeing Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala. I kind of made it a point to also tell them that in Ireland, we're aware of their story. We can see them. We've seen it on our television sets. We know who you are. And the people in Ireland are thinking of you and they're rooting for you. And at the risk of getting emotional, that meant an awful lot to them. It meant an awful lot to hear that that people in Ireland knew about them. And I think within justice, one of the terrible things is the sense that no one else knows what's going on behind these walls.
And also the human beings behind the story. So we hear about the caravan and we hear about it in terms of like this unstoppable, there's a dehumanizing terms, isn't there? Like it's like this unstoppable trail of ants or something trying to invade America and the language that's used.
Yeah, a lot of news media column, I find sometimes it can be quite voyeuristic. And in Casa de Migrante, which is in Guatemala City, it's one of three stopping off houses that they have in Guatemala. I spoke there to Carol, who runs the operation. She told me they have 65 beds, and for the last number of years, they've been coping with individuals and families and small groups. When they heard that there was a caravan en route with several thousand people in it, they had no idea what to expect. She said the evening they arrived in Guatemala City, it was like a tsunami. 17,000 people arrived. They managed to sleep 600 people in the Casa de Migrante building. Across the road, they got access to a warehouse. There was 1,000 people put up there for the night. The local diocese provided another accommodation centre for 200 or 300 people, and the university opened up some dormitories there as well. So, but there were still about 13,000 people slept on the streets. And I said to her, I said, where did TROCRA come in on this? She said, we contacted TROCRA straight away. They said, what are they asking for? Because it's about the people, what they want. And she said they're looking for transport. They're looking for trucks. They're trying to get to the Mexican or the, well, ultimately to the U.S. border. And Troker's response was, we can't do that. That would be seen as tantamount to trafficking people. We can't do that, but what else can we do for you? And the answer back was, well, we need water, we need inflatable beds, we need Medipacks. And within hours, there was vans pulling up, unloading everything from toothbrushes to water for these human beings who were fleeing their countries. And when I spoke to them, because we were offered an opportunity to speak, so we said, certainly, if they're happy to talk to us. And as it turns out, they were dying to talk to us. And the first four people I met, just to give you the idea of the humanity behind the numbers, four people. Guy number one from Honduras, a gay rights activist. He told me that up to about 3 years ago, he could go about his work quite happily. He said, things have reversed in Central America. He said, all the gains that have been made are sliding backwards. Countries are becoming more autocratic. The military are becoming stronger and human rights are on the wane. He said, I know, he said, could be shot for fun in Honduras by the military or by anybody in the street. I'm a known gay activist. I'm running for my life. The second guy was from El Salvador. He was a young guy. I'm not sure what his issues at home were, but he said if he returned to San Salvador, he would be shot without doubt by a gang in San Salvador. The next person I met was a little lady, little woman, about 30. She was the size of a sparrow. She had two little children with her. And she told me that her 10-year-old boy had fled the night before with her husband because the narco gangs wanted to use him as a mule to transport drugs. So the husband left with the little boy. She followed on in the morning and tried to get a head start before people realized that she was missing. She said she didn't know where her husband and son were in Guatemala, but she expected that she would catch up with them through the offices of Casa de Migrante. And the fourth guy put his hand up and said, I'm from the Honduran army. He said, we've been asked to act against our own people too many times, he said. So 33 of us deserted last week, he said. And I don't know where the other 32 are, but I've run to Guatemala.
When you see a situation as big as that, how do you, and indeed the people you encounter, how do they avoid despair? What are the little things that people cling on to?
The only thing I would say is, genuinely, there were some very positive stories too. Like certainly the women of Cepo Sarco, from a tiny village, barefoot women with no education, getting justice, getting it over the line through the help, as I said, of Trocra and various other organisations on the ground. Similarly, there are other families, like the people we met in the Polo Cheek Valley, who've been moved on because of plantations being spread out into their land. It's a universal story. Whenever big business sits down with politicians, not all the time, but there's always the risk that something will get stamped, that permission will be granted, that planning will be given. And we've seen it in our own country. So you can imagine when you're dealing with an indigenous people who don't even speak the language of law and who don't really understand the concept of title deed, whose relationship with the trees is a personal relationship. You can imagine the distress that is caused when the bulldozers arrive and flatten their little houses and flatten the trees from which they have fed for generations and generations and generations, to plant palm oil. And we are part of the problem, unfortunately. The EU has now, they've amended their position somewhat in this move to renewable energies and to biofuels. There is an encouragement to move to palm oil and sugarcane to produce juice to run our cars and so on. The problem with that is that palm oil is causing havoc, really, to the land in Guatemala, amongst other countries. And there's a lot of healing to be done, and there's a lot of firming up to be done. There's problems in Honduras and El Salvador and all over South America as well, as you know.
It sounds like the work will go on, but in telling those stories, John, at least we cannot say we didn't know. Thank you very much for joining us for that great pen picture of your trip to Guatemala, and hopefully our listeners will take it upon themselves to, on the back of that, do a little bit more reading and find out a bit more about somewhere they may not have been aware of before.
And be careful about what you buy. Where do those bananas come from? You know, the best you can, the best you can.
John Creedon, thank you very much.
Thanks a million, Colin. Bye. Bye-bye.
Our next guest is from Syria, but has been living in Ireland since 2011. She is a journalist with Storyful and a regular speaker about Syria and refugee rights. In 2016, she was named the Tatler International Woman of the Year. Razan Ibrahim, you're very welcome to the show. Can you tell us about your life before you came to Ireland?
So I came from Latakia, a coastal Mediterranean city by the Turkish borders. And like any Irish child, I was a very naughty child. Having a great childhood, playing in the streets with my friends, going to school like any Irish child, and trying to build myself step by step. Latakia is such a beautiful, liberal city in Syria, which is you have kind of the freedom to be able to do something, to start something, and to build your life, for the future. So, I came from this town. I came from amazing parents. My mom and dad are school principals, and education for them was number one. So that was highly important in our family, and that's why we worked hard to get better education, to go to schools, universities, and of course to continue our studies later.
You were coming to Ireland anyway in 2011 to do a college degree or a master's?
Exactly. So in 2011, I arrived to Ireland to do my master's in UL, University of Limerick. And I did my master's in English language teaching. But my whole plan was to finish my studies and go back home and set up my own language school, and I bring what I have learned from Ireland in terms of education, culture, language, and society back to Syria. But unfortunately, the violence escalated and the war broke out at that time.
Did the war break out as you were in Ireland?
The war broke out when I was in Syria in 2011. So I witnessed around 4 months of the conflict in my hometown. And I was lucky, actually, because I arrived to Ireland by plane, whereas later on, years to come, millions of people struggled and took a deadly trip by the Mediterranean to arrive to Europe. So, yeah, that was how I came to Ireland.
What's it like being in a modern city? Obviously, Latakia is an extremely old city, but a modern, free, as you describe, liberal city. There must be incredible disbelief when civil conflict and then war breaks out. You must be thinking, this must be a dream. I presume it's going to end now. You know, you watch a modern society start to be destroyed. What is that like?
Exactly. So as Latakia is part of bigger Syria, and it is liberal, free, and people trying to make it a better place. However, what we were missing, and it was something very important and crucial to any society to develop, which is political freedom. And that's why people started to call for dignity, for freedom, for basic human rights. Because no matter how the society will be developed and free, you need a political system working alongside with the society to make a better place for everybody. So this is what we were missing back home. And this is why people wanted to have better life as well, in terms of expressing their opinion, in terms of choosing a government, having a say, for example, fighting corruption, equality between all Syrians. So this was crucial, and people have been waiting for this chance for a long time.
You came here, some of your family then, did they follow you?
Yeah, so I have my brother followed me in 2015, my sister and my parents, my mom and dad. My mom and dad stayed in Syria back here in Ireland for 1 month, but they decided to go back. And it was extremely difficult decision. But, you know, when I think of it right now, I understand it's extremely difficult to get people uprooted from their houses, from their land, from their daily life, and put them in a new society, new language, new culture.
Particularly later in life than, say, you or your siblings.
Definitely. And I remember one word from my dad when we were discussing why they want to go back. My dad replied, "Who is going to take care of our olive trees?" He has a small, beautiful olive trees land where he since he was a child, he inherited from his father. Oh, who's going to take care of that? And that was his argument to go back to Syria. So I'm just saying that because people think that leaving your country and starting a new life in another country is, oh, it's easy, piece of cake. It's not. It's very hard, very tough. And main importantly, people are forced to do that. It's not their choice.
When your siblings joined you, had they changed based on living for 3 or 4 years in a war-torn country? Did you find that you had to get to know them again?
They were changed so much, and we kind of making very close relation to help them to get on. For a few examples, let's say my brother was unable to sleep at night, like calmly. If he hears any ambulance, he will wake up in the middle of the night, freak out, there is something bad happened. Or I personally, till now, if I see, for example, like a police or an army or like just randomly in the street, you'll straight away will jump into fear. So these kind of things were not easy. When they arrived, we started to really have a strong bond, stay together all the time and help each other, support each other emotionally. So we like really helped my brothers especially to get more into work in Ireland, get to know more people, try to integrate with the Irish people, Irish culture. My sister is the same. It was not easy, but I'm very proud of them, to be honest. They did really great and a great example of integration.
And in the area of integration, do you think there is a piece of work that needs to be done to explain to people who are observing refugees coming that it's a complex situation for people coming here? It's not just that they have arrived and if they catch their breath and then they start a new life, that there's a lot of human emotion, a lot of complex emotions for a refugee who arrives in Ireland because they may have all had different experiences to each other even. And so for us, it's about listening at the start.
Exactly. And it's a lot of memories, a lot of experiences. They are bringing them to here. However, I believe integration is not only from one part. Integration should be from both, from the refugees and from the hosting society and community. They both should make effort to know about each other, to learn about each other, and to talk about each other. But integrating one party and leaving the community, not knowing who are these people, why they are coming here, what is their culture, it's not gonna be a perfect solution. Should be both the society, the refugees, both together integrated in each other's culture.
Do you think refugees are sometimes reluctant to allow themselves to feel at home in their new place of residence because they feel, I want to go home. I want to go back to Syria. So I don't want to put down roots here. I don't want to be hurt again in going home. Is that somewhere in the psyche?
Of course it is. And there is something important. And as I mentioned before, refugees, they didn't choose to travel to here. They were forced. So they were forced to be in a society. They want to start just to be safe, to be secure, to live, or then to have a roof. This is what they're the basic requirement at the beginning. But then after this stage, they should make more effort in knowing the society, integrate more. For example, myself, when I came here and I knew that this is going to be my second home, I started to listen to Irish TV, Irish newspaper, Irish radios, talk more in politics here or the society, the law. So it's important to know all of these.
Out of curiosity, in listening to the radio here, what struck you about us and our predilections and obsessions? Do we have similar concerns? Like, did you listen to Liveline and hear people ringing in and say, actually, it's much the same as what we'd be ringing in about at home? Or is there a particularly Irish obsessions that struck you straight away?
No, it's actually very, very similar. We share very similar concerns and similar problems. This is what makes me as well believe that actually we, like, eventually we all live in a world that we have the same interests, the same problems, the same concerns. It's very similar, and some of them, especially when it comes to problems between families or problems between neighbors, it's extremely what we have back home, you know, in Syria. So it's very similar between the two societies.
In a situation where people arrive under stress and often, you know, not in huge numbers, but people are coming, what would you advise us to learn about appreciating the differences, the different types of people coming?
First, I would like to say that don't worry. It is not easy. And even for us Syrians, it's not easy as well for us in terms of Syrian society. Syrian society is complex. It's kind of piece of mosaic where people from different religion, ethnicities, languages, and not only that, people from different countries. I'll tell you, we have people from Greece. They still live in Syria till today. Armenians, Palestinians, Iraqis. We have from Algeria. So it's as well society complex, texture of the society. But we Syrians are very open. And we would love people to show interest and ask questions and try to know us more and more, because although we are from different backgrounds, but Syrians in general, they share as well one umbrella. You know, we have common personalities and aspects all together. But like personally, I have faced some of these questions or ideas about Syria. They would say, for example, oh, you're drinking Guinness. So in Syria, do you drink? Or I was like, yeah, we have our national drink, which is arak, very similar to raki. And or they might say, okay, so in Syria, do you go back and wear hijab? I was like, no, I don't. But there are women, they do. So it's up to the women, up where they are from, and it's personal freedom about that, you know. So you will always get these kind of questions. But as I said, don't worry, because it's not an easy society, you know. It's varied. It's different from place to place, from city to city. And it is a very interesting society and interesting people.
Talking about complexity, one system that I'm fairly sure does not respect complexity of the different nationalities or nationalities within a nation is the direct provision system. It seems, even at a cold level, to be inefficient, unnecessarily dehumanizing. But I wonder, what would you recommend for a country like Ireland, which has people coming in? What is the system? And there's maybe a very difficult answer to this question, so I'm not asking for the full solution. But in stepping back, let's say I'm a government minister and people are saying, scrap direct provision. My next question would be, replace it with what? Where would you start in designing a system?
Direct provision is depressing place. And only yesterday we heard very sad news of asylum seeker in direct provision center in Kildare, took his own life. And this is just one example to show you how the whole system is unfunctioning and depressing for people. And it's making life way harder. Maybe the mistakes they were in the process was very slow. This is number one. So like, for example, I know families, they have been 7 years in the system. These families, now they have children, 7 years and 8 years and 10 years. They speak Irish, they speak English. It's too late. The Irish government here, the process should be faster in making decisions. But when it takes 5, 6, 7 years, the children, they don't know their homeland. They only know Ireland. Even to be honest, like on like if I'm in power, even if I know now that actually their application 6 years ago was not right, not correct, I will still not deport them anymore. It's time to make a very revolutionist decision. The people, and especially families, without like any really complexity, make them stay in Ireland, give them refugee status, let them start a new life because they can't do it back home anymore. And really make the process from the zero a new process where it is fast, it is efficient and like practical. But now to solve it with deporting people, it's no way, it's no question. You can't uproot the children from the schools, from their community, from their Irishness. They are Irish now, you know. They don't speak even their native language. It's too late.
When you read about Syria and try to keep up hope, what do you cling to? Because even the core government is also the one that was protested against 8 years ago.
In Syria, there will be no improvement or a total end of the war without a new political system, no matter how much we tried and how much we say, oh, the war it ends here and in this city or in this place. Still, without a new political system that is voted democratically by the people, we will never have the end of the war, or we will never have a peace in general. But how to do that? It's extremely complex. Why? Because it's not Syrian decision anymore, unfortunately. Now, Syrians, they can't decide what they want. Interference from almost every single country in the world. Competition between US and Russia on the Syrian land. Turkey interfering. Part of Lebanon, Iran existing there. Israel is playing unbelievable negative part inside Syria. And then we have the European Union silent. And that's, I think, where we are missing. If the European Union and United Nations were strong enough to stand and present their view, what should be done? They have the will. It's not only they really want to solve it. I think they could be a very good influential part. But unfortunately, they are away from what's happening, and they are giving very, very little voice and solution to the problem.
You have made a life here. And what do you think about Ireland now? Is it second home? Is it home? What's your feeling now?
It's a difficult question because I felt when, like, the first step I took in Ireland, I felt, oh, this is where I belong. This is my new home. This is exactly how I feel about Ireland. But I am Syrian too. And I am very, very proud Syrian. And I love my homeland. And then I get to conclusion, why do I have identity? Why should I be either this or that? I am actually everything. This is exactly how I feel. I feel I am Irish and I belong to the people, to the country, and I'm Syrian, and I can't wait to go back as well to Syria. And I feel as well I belong to anybody. Like, for example, I belong to refugees because I am personally a refugee, even though I have the Irish nationality, but I am still a refugee. I still can't go home. I'm still living in a country because my country is in a war. So I'd say it's very complex, but as I said, I am Syrian Irish, and I truly, from the bottom of my heart, I feel it this way.
Rosanne, can you tell me a bit about something that you're involved now with refugees? Community sponsorship.
Exactly. So it's a new project run in a coalition between the Irish government and NGOs like United Nations and Amnesty International about providing or organizing, I'd say, civil community to help and sponsor one Syrian family. This civil community, they will be the new family of the Syrian family. They will be their friends. They will help them to get along with daily practical things in life. They will guide them. They will be their companion across maybe 18 months. So this is a new project. It started in Canada, and it has been extremely successful. So other European countries and even in South America, they are now trying to start this project here in their countries and now in Ireland. We have received the first family in December. Now the second family, which is going to be the first formal and official in Waterford, Lismore. And I can tell you the reaction of the civil community and the local community in the town and other towns, like extremely positive, and they can't wait to help the newcomers, I'd say the new Irish.
Razan Ibrahim, thank you so much for coming to talk to us.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you very much.
That's all we have time for today here on The World Etc. My thanks to Razan and John for joining us. We've had a few queries regarding our theme music, so I'd just like to give a quick mention to the Dublin band Glossolalia and their song, which you hear every month. It's called Clones. I will be back next month for another episode of The World Etc. But in the meantime, we'd be absolutely delighted if you subscribed to the podcast. You can find us in all the usual places at iTunes, Acast, Spotify and Audioboom. So if you see us, do click the subscribe button and you'll be able to listen to all the new episodes as they appear. Thank you for listening. I've been Colm O'Regan. Talk to you later. Sweet desire.